You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Scott Adams created Dilbert in 1989 when he was working at the Pacific Bell Phone Company. His cartoon now appears in 2,000 newspapers in 65 countries and is the most downloaded and emailed comic strip in the world. In a combination memoir and advice book called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, Kind of the Story of My Life, Mr. Adams discusses his own business failures and how they eventually led him to success. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Do you think of your years at Pacific Bell to have been a failure?
Well, in the sense that I did not rise to the level of CEO and didn't really rise much at all, so yes.
Had you held down any other jobs before you created Dilbert?
Held down is a funny term for the jobs I had. Yeah, I worked at a bank, Crocker Bank, for a number of years. My first job there was a bank teller where I was robbed twice at gunpoint and thought, I either need to leave here or get promoted. And I got promoted, small promotion.
You also were in computer programming.
I tried to program for a while, mostly self-taught.
Did you find that pretty much all offices functioned in the same ways?
When I was at the bank, I thought, there's no way that this stuff happens anywhere else. This has just got to be the defects with the people I work with. And when I left to the phone company thinking I'd gone to heaven and now all my problems would be solved, same problems. It turns out when you put three people in a room and one of them thinks they're in charge, you get the same stuff.
And then you said you never became the CEO of Pacific Bell. You say that at both Crocker and Pacific Bell, orders had come down to stop promoting white males.
Yeah. So after how many tens of thousands of years of things favoring the white male, there was this tiny sliver in time that just caught me at the wrong time, right at the time when my career was starting to take off, or potentially take off, that both companies told me, and this is not my interpretation, both bosses in both companies brought me in and said, we're getting too much attention because we don't have any diversity at the top. We can't promote you.
How did you manage to create Dilbert while you were working full time?
Well, it was actually easier to write it while I was working full-time, except for the hours. I got up at 4 in the morning and worked before work and then worked after work and weekends. But the material for the strip was just falling in my lap, so that part was easy.
Did you have to continue to work at the phone company after the strip came syndicated?
Yeah, I stayed there for several years.
You weren't making enough money from a syndicated comic strip?
It was a very slow start, yeah. In the first couple of years, it was almost nothing. So it was a slow build, and there were a number of lucky and sometimes skillful things that caused the bump up to the higher level.
And then you also have started a number of businesses because cartooning hasn't been enough for you?
Yeah, I get restless. I'm always working on two or three side projects. And right now I've got an internet startup I'm working on that's just getting ready to launch, calendartree.com. And what I do is I try to choose my projects, and this is part of what I talk about in the book, is that I'm picking things that even if they don't work out, I'm going to develop a new skill that will layer well with the skills that I have. So I don't pick anything that has a real failure. I can either learn something, which is valuable, or the thing itself can work.
And now you also write a blog that's been stirring up some controversy, and not Dilbert-related, like the one about doctor-assisted suicide.
Yeah, my father passed recently after a long illness, and this caused me to go on an angry rant on my blog about those who would oppose my option, at least, or his option, as the case may be, to end it with some dignity.
Well, let's go back to when you were still working at Pacific Bell and doing Dilbert. What were some of the things that that you were witnessing or you were part of that wound up going into the cartoons? And were your fellow workers aware that this was happening?
They were very aware, to the point where I'd often be in a meeting and somebody would say something that sounded dumb even as it came out of their mouth. And they would turn to me and say, can you make a comic out of that? And I often did. But the single biggest thing that came out of that was the Dilber Principle, which became a best-selling book. And that was the idea that because technology workers were rather rare and valuable, the last thing you wanted to do was promote one to management where they would become suddenly worthless. Mm-hmm. So you ended up promoting the less qualified people to management, which caused a real absurdity.
And that's kind of a component of the Peter Principle, where somebody is promoted to the point a competent person is promoted to the point where he or she is no longer competent and then stays in that job.
Well, the Dilber Principle is specifically saying that you're intentionally taking your bad workers and putting there, whereas the Peter Principle is just that's how things evolve.
And you witness that? The boss is actually making that decision?
Well, it's my interpretation.
I see.
That some
you
of
wondered
bosses...
why Joe got the job rather than Mary, who is so much better.
Well, I did observe that the best technology people tended not to be promoted. They were paid well, but they weren't promoted because you didn't want to squander their talents.
And then you report that you began to experience pain in your pinky that made it impossible for you to draw.
Yeah, it wasn't pain so much as a spasm. So whenever my hand held a pencil... And this very specific motion and no other bothered it. As soon as the pencil or pen touched the paper, my pinky would spasm and take control of my hand. So I couldn't draw for about a year.
So what happened? Could you use computers to do the drawing for you?
So at the time I was drawing on paper, and shortening this story, the first time it came up, I found that I could kind of reprogram my brain just by touching pen to paper very briefly until I could do it for a whole second, then 5 seconds. When it got to about 7 seconds or so, my hand actually, because this is a brain problem, not a finger problem, the brain actually rewired itself. And so for a few years, I could draw okay. I overused it a second time, and then the problem came back. And that's when I went to the Wacom computer. The company is Wacom, and they make something called the Cintiq, and allows me to draw directly to the computer screen.
So you didn't ever cure it?
I cured it in the sense because drawing on the screen was just different enough than the motion of drawing on paper that my brain didn't recognize it and let me do it.
But you still can't draw on paper.
I could if I didn't do it for long. So I could draw, you know, a sketch. I couldn't do a lot.
My guest is Scott Adams, whose follow-up to his New York Times bestseller, The Dilbert Principle, is How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. How did you first get Dilbert syndicated and published?
So there's a long version of the story, but I'll shorten that to I got some advice from a cartoonist who told me to buy a specific book that tells you how to get syndicated. And it's embarrassingly easy. So unlike becoming an actor or even publishing a book if you're an unknown, which is really hard to break into, cartooning is simply take a photocopy of your cartoon samples, mail them to, in those days, there were about 6 addresses. Today, there are just a few. And there are only 6 editors in the world then who could say yes, and then they would syndicate you, which means that they would split the profits with you and they'd do the business stuff like selling it while you did the art.
And you said that it took a while to take off, even though you were probably getting your best material in those days.
Well, in the early days, it wasn't about work. So for the first few years, it was a generic comic. He had a job, but I didn't show him at the job that often.
Mm-hmm. So it took off when you finally put him in a cubicle with other people in cubicles?
Yeah, and that happened because I ran my email address in the strip back in the days when email was more of a novelty. And thousands of people wrote in and said, we kind of like the strip, but we love it when he's in the office. So I changed it.
Were they sending in things that you might use, material you might use?
Yeah. After I made it more of a workplace strip, then I would get, you know, hundreds of suggestions a day for years.
Well, since you've been drawing Dilbert for over 20 years, many of them away from the workforce, where do you get your ideas now?
Still email. A lot of people are still emailing me. But I'm also immersed in a number of business things myself. And the business world has patterns that no matter what kind of business you're in, you end up seeing those same patterns. So as I mentioned, working on the startup or before I had some restaurants, I did a food company in the past. Those things didn't work out. but they all gave me lots of fodder for the strip.
And you write that psychology was a huge factor in your eventual success with Dilbert.
Yeah, I'm kind of an armchair student of psychology, so I don't have any kind of credentials. But I found that every time you absorb a new interesting fact about psychology, it gives you like a mini superpower. It allows you to understand things that people don't understand, sell things that people can't sell. It's a powerful force.
Have you done a study of office dynamics? Because that's what really is the theme that runs through Dilbert.
A study in what sense?
Well, because the way the hierarchical situations that occur in pretty much every office.
Well, I don't think anything I've done would qualify as a study. I don't I'm not that rigorous, but I'm a student of it, let's say.
Well, didn't you once go undercover as a management consultant? That must have been your attempt at research.
Yeah, I did. The San Jose Mercury News, one of my local newspapers, asked me to don a professional disguise with a big old mustache and a wig. And I went into a company called Logitech. They make mouses and other peripherals. And only the CEO was in on the joke. So he had his top management team there, and I pretended to be a famous consultant. Ray Maybear was my fake name. And my plan was to get them, see if I could get them to collectively, during that meeting, write the worst mission statement ever written and convince them that it was brilliant, and then ask them to put it to music. And so that plan actually worked.
I've actually seen management consultants who've done stupid things. So I had to say completely. I never understood why they were hired.
Well, it was during a time when there was so much management silliness that nobody doubted anything that came out of a consultant's mouth.
You say that goals are for losers.
So goals are not completely useless, but what you need is a system instead. So, for example, if your goal is to be, let's say, an Olympic shot putter, and you put all your energy into that, well, 99.99% are not going to win the gold medal in that. And in the meantime, they've developed no useful skill that has a carryover. As opposed to what I do is I choose projects that even if they fail, they leave me with a skill. So my corporate career, for example, gave me a lot of business skills. And while I'm a poor artist and I don't have a writing background, I'm not the greatest writer in the world, not the funniest person in the room, but I'm pretty good at all those things. And when you put them together, you've got the Dilbert Empire. So my observation is that you can layer fairly ordinary skills together. If you get the right combination, it becomes valuable.
You're kind of putting down your skills as the creator of Dilbert?
Well, nobody has ever called me a great artist, so I think I'm just being realistic there.
But it's like Schultz and so many others. As long as you create images that are able to communicate your story, does it really matter whether you are Rembrandt?
You reminded me of a quote from Schultz himself. I got to know him a little bit late in his life, and he said that I was a terrible artist at first, but eventually he came around and he decided that I, quote, draw funny. And he said that was the point. You need to draw funny.
You also advise people to conquer shyness by being huge phonies.
Yeah, I'm genetically shy. You know, I was born shy. I blush easily. And in college, I met a friend who was literally an actor, so he took acting classes on the side. And he showed me how to just pretend like you were a confident adult. You know, when you're 18, 19, you just don't feel that way when you're talking to legitimate adults. And I would just copy him. I would literally act like an actor. So I was like two levels removed from the real thing. But the thing is that most people can't tell the difference. When you're talking to them, you just look like you're poised and confident. Then they treat you that way, and then you feel that way. So it becomes kind of a self-reinforcing thing.
And that has worked for you over the years?
Absolutely. That and the Dale Carnegie course, which—
You took the Dale Carnegie course?
I did. And they don't pay me, but it would sound like it, the commercials I do for them. It's the most useful thing I've ever done.
You also tried your hand at hypnosis.
I became a hypnotist, studied hypnosis, got certified in it. And that would be the second most— I guess maybe a tie with the Dale Carnegie course for the most useful things, because it permeates everything you do.
Well, I don't understand, other than getting people to suddenly cluck like a chicken without realizing they're doing it.
So hypnosis is kind of the shorthand version of psychology in general. When you learn hypnosis, you learn to treat people as more of a input and output and not a rational being. So if you do these things, you get these results. And some of the observations of hypnosis permeate my writing as well as Dilbert.
Didn't you once lose your ability to speak?
For about 3.5 years, I lost my ability to speak to a rare disorder. Not too rare. There are about 30,000 people in the country who have it.
Separate from the pinky problem?
Separate but related. So it turns out that the voice problem, where my vocal cords clenched, and the pinky problem, where the pinky spasmed, they often come in pairs. So luckily, it doesn't progress beyond that. And in my case, I lost the ability to speak for about 3.5 years.
That's a long time.
Took a long time to even figure out what the problem was, because it looked like a mental problem, because I had the same thing a stutterer has, in the sense that I could talk to my cat, but I couldn't talk if the phone rang.
And then you were told there was no cure.
Well, there was no cure, as far as anybody knew at that point, but it took me that long to search down through Google, through my own research, through my doctors, and finally found the one doctor in the world, Dr. Gerald Burke down at UCLA, top doctor in the field of ear, nose, throat stuff. And he had developed a surgery that he said would work for most people, but if it didn't work, it was a big risk. I took that surgery, and it worked.
It's kind of scary to take brain surgery.
Well, it wasn't brain surgery. If you see, the listeners will hear that I've got a big scar on my neck. So what he did was rewire the nerves in my neck, and it worked.
Well, you were giving speeches and talks, so this had to have a real impact on your career.
So the two biggest parts of my work were drawing, and I had the pinky problem, and then giving speeches to corporate groups usually, and then I lost my voice. So those were tough times.
Well, I'm very pleased that the surgery was a success. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had this chance to talk with you about your new book that is from Portfolio Penguin. It's called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. Thank you so much, Scott Adams, for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.